Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 28th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Richard Robaum. Today's session number is ROR 2005, and it's titled The Art and Science of Observation. Let's listen in.
For a while, one thing that I haven't paid enough attention to are the ground squirrels and chipmunks. That might be an assignment for somebody. I have a book that tells how to tell them apart, how to tell one species from another. What I was thinking, I'm going to read some examples, and I have quite a trove of books with words and pictures, both drawn and photographed, which are examples of close observation. Close observation is almost a meditative process. Anyone who has drawn or has had to write a careful description of something appreciates the intense focus that something well observed requires. And the description that comes out of that, whether it's a graphic description or a verbal one, or just a photograph that is well composed and well focused and captures all of the elements of the thing observed, conveys a great deal more information than a simple snapshot or what resides in the memory after a quick glance at something. And there's a process of learning and of revelation that goes along with that. I have some examples. This by Edward Abbey, author of his most famous book, Desert Solitaire. He was an accomplished naturalist as well as an accomplished writer, and something of a crank as well. The cliff rose is a sturdy shrub with gnarled trunk and twisting branches, growing sometimes to twice a man's height. When not in bloom, it might not catch your eye, but after the winter snows and a trace of rain in the spring, it comes on suddenly and gloriously, like a swan, like a maiden, and the shaggy limbs go out of sight behind dense clusters of flowers, creamy white or pale yellow, like wild roses, each with its five perfect petals and a golden center. I would venture to say that if you were walking through the Arches National Monument near Moab and you just happened across this shrub, you would know from Edward Abbey's description what you were looking at. And you would be twice delighted by it for having read about it first and then recognized it from his spare but carefully observed description. Five perfect petals, a golden center, a shaggy, gnarly thing that suddenly expresses through its reproductive efforts its essential beauty. And this from Annie Dillard. This is a quote I was looking for yesterday, and I read a substitute instead. Another example of careful observation, and also a contrast of scale. With the naked eye, I can see 2 million light years to the Andromeda Galaxy. Often I slop some creek water in a jar. When I get home, I dump it in a white china bowl. After the silt settles, I return and see tracings of minute snails on the bottom, a planarian or two winding round the rim of water, roundworms shimmying frantically, and finally, when my eyes have adjusted to these dimensions, amoebae. At first, the amoebae look like those curled moving spots you seem to see in your eyes when you stare at a distant wall. Then I see the amoebae as drops of water congealed, bluish, translucent, like chips of sky in a bowl. At length, I choose one individual and give myself over to its idea of an evening. I see it dribble a grainy foot before it on its wet, unfathomable way. Do its unedited sense impressions include the fierce focus of my eyes? Shall I take it outside and show it Andromeda and blow its little ectoplasm? Okay, one more. This from John Steinbeck. I was looking in the library for Grapes of Wrath, which has an exquisite description of an ant pushing a little dung ball over the road. Steinbeck was good friends with a fellow named Ricketts, who was the character on whom Doc in Cannery Row is modeled. And Ricketts, together with some of his colleagues who were at Stanford University, wrote a book called Between Pacific Tides, which I think now is in its eighth edition. It's a classic and just a splendid account of the intertidal marine life on the Pacific coast. So Steinbeck was well acquainted with scientists and with science. His deepest probing was into the human soul, but his careful observation extended to the natural world as well. Doc was collecting marine animals in the great tide pool on the tip of the peninsula. It is a fabulous place. When the tide is in a wave-churned basin, creamy with foam, whipped by the combers that roll in from the whistling buoy on the reef. But when the tide goes out, the little water world becomes quiet and lovely. The sea is very clear, and the bottom becomes fantastic with hurrying, fighting, feeding, breeding animals. Crabs rush from frond to frond of the waving algae. Starfish squat over mussels and limpets, attach their million little suckers, and then slowly lift with incredible power until the prey is broken from the rock. And then the starfish stomach comes out and envelops its food. Orange and speckled and fluted nudibranchs slide gracefully over the rocks, their skirts waving like the dresses of Spanish dancers. And black eels poke their heads out of crevices and wait for prey. The snapping shrimps with their trigger claws pop loudly. The lovely colored world is glassed over. Hermit crabs, like frantic children, scamper on the bottom sand. And now one, finding an empty snail shell he likes better than his own, creeps out, exposing his soft body to the enemy for a moment, and then pops into the new shell. Well, that's all in one little tide pool. In maybe 10 or 15 minutes of close observation by somebody who knew what he was looking at. But of course, the only way you get to know what you're looking at is by looking at it, and looking at it, and looking at it. And not as a tedium, but as a delight. A friend of mine, who actually was the village potter at one time here at Holden, and now is doing interpretive work at the Seattle Zoo, somebody I met through the Washington Native Plant Society, gave me a copy of an account by one of Louis Agassiz's students of his first exercise with Dr. Agassiz. Agassiz was a Swiss-trained zoologist who came to Harvard University while still early in his career and became one of the foremost innovators in scientific education during the 19th century. His great failing was that he couldn't accept natural selection. And so he was also the prime opponent of Darwin in the United States. But thankfully, Darwin had his defender in a botanist, the author of Gray's Manual of Botany, Asa Gray, who gave a ringing defense of the theory of natural selection and Darwin's contributions, which are immeasurable. Anyway, I digress. Augustine had a young graduate student or a prospective graduate student come to him and said, I would really like to study under you. I'm interested particularly in entomology, or the study of insects. And Augustine says, well, all right. Why don't you look at this fish for a while? And he pulls down from the shelf a fish preserved in alcohol. They weren't using formaldehyde at the time. Alcohol has the disadvantage of being volatile. It evaporates quickly. So Augustine said, you know, there's no decent scientist worthy of the name who fails to take meticulous care of his specimens. And so he opened the jar, poured the fish out into an examining tray, and handed the young man a brush and says, and you will keep the surface of this fish moist as you study it, and then return it carefully to the jar from which you took it, and we will then have a specimen preserved as well as the one which I just took out. And the young man goes, okay. And he sat himself down to begin to study his fish. And he looked at it, and he started to make a list of characteristics on a sheet of paper, and he looked at it some more, and then he looked at his watch, and then he looked at the fish again, and then he looked around the room and wondered where Professor Augustine had gone, because it had been 2 hours now, and he still had this fish in front of him, and he thought perhaps he had been forgotten. Well, about 4 hours later, Augustine did come back and checked in and said, well, how's it going? And the man said, well, I've spent a good 4 hours with this fish, and I think I've examined a great many interesting details about its structure. And Augustine said, very good. Well, come back tomorrow, and you can look at this fish some more.
Oh.
So he came back the next day, and Augustine says, well, what have you observed about this fish? And he gave him a number of things. Well, I note that the eyes are on opposite sides of its head, and face sideways and rather than forward. So very likely this fish lacks binocular vision, which is the vision that we have that allows us to see in depth, gives us depth perception. So obviously this. Well, that's very good. There's one very important detail that I think you have missed. So why don't you spend another day with this fish and then tell me what you come up with at the end of that day? Well, this process went on interminably, almost as long as the story I'm telling. In fact, the young man ended up spending 3 days with this fish. He made numerous meticulous sketches of it, and when he finally reported to Augustine the revelation that he had was that, in fact, the fish had complete symmetry on both sides of its body. Our bodies, by the way, as you may know, are asymmetrical. Our hearts are not actually shaped like this, right in the middle of our chests. And then there's the liver over here. Augustine was fairly well pleased with the results, and later, the student did go on to become a professor of entomology, but he was always capable of drawing this fish in meticulous detail at any opportunity or any occasion that required it. So anyhow, the lesson there is that you can look and look and look for a long, long time and not see everything. And that's what we're going to try to do here today. What I would like is for people after this class to dedicate an hour of the time you have remaining at Holden Village to an observation. And I'd like to invite your suggestions about what to observe. I'm going to put a couple up here. I've already mentioned a chipmunk, ground squirrel. So that's one idea. It would be kind of nice if we could, we could, I think, just borrow a scrap of space on the ark just to inform people of significant findings that they might not be aware of. Chipmunk, versus ground squirrel. I have a book I can lend to anyone who's interested in observing these critters and whatever you can find out about them. I watched one for about 20 minutes today, and it was really very interesting. At one point, it stuffed its mouth with grass, dry grass, and then it found something more interesting, and it spat out the dry grass, and I've noticed they've been lopping off the heads of dandelions around here. If you go around and look for little specks of yellow on the grass, you'll see lots of little traces of what used to be dandelion flowers, and it's the chipmunks, or the ground squirrels, that are doing it. So, anyway, that's just one example of what you could do for observation. Anybody have something else to offer, an idea of what might lend itself well to...
So are there two different critters, or is this just...
There are two different critters, a big one and a little one. There are particular species of those critters, too. And I have just the book that will help you tell them apart, Mammals of the Northwest, and I've already got the relevant pages tagged here. So if anyone wants to assume that responsibility, take that assignment, enjoy that diversion, you're welcome to it. Any other ideas?
The iris.
The iris. It's a good one. I need to see if Rebecca Wee has the poem by Mary Oliver about the iris flower. It's quite a fine one, and that's a good example of careful and beautiful observation.
The butterflies.
Butterflies.
What kind are the butterflies that we're seeing up on the trail?
Well, several.
The larger ones that look like monarchs but are yellow and brown?
Well, they're tiger swallowtails. There are, I think, two kinds of tiger swallowtails. There's also a mourning cloak and... I forget the name of the other one, an orange one. Any other suggestions? Ideas?
Are you just looking for living things?
Not necessarily, no.
Well, maybe the clouds.
Good one, yeah. Clouds? The sky. The night sky. Or one part of the night sky. I was thinking you could observe a child. It's nice to be able to watch someone without interfering, without affecting what they're doing. I thought about, you could say watch another person, but then that's a little too voyeuristic, maybe. But a child sort of, that's okay. A stream. I've got a nice description of a stream by Gary Snyder from his book Mountains and Rivers Without End, which is in the library and in the bookstore. A wonderful poet. Used to hang out with Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. He's a Buddhist. But he looked at a stream. Just a short thing here. This is what he saw. Upwellings, side swirls, back swirls, curl overs, out ripples, eddies, chops and swells, washovers, shallows, confluence, turbulence, wash seam wavelets, ripples. And those are each one a discrete observation of his. He's not just stringing together words. These are things that he saw in the water. And you could just look at a short piece of stream, or maybe just even a plunge pool or a riffle, a little rapids, and see a great deal. You might turn over rocks and find caddisfly larvae. Some other things. You could observe the snack bar. Or one person serving ice cream in the snack bar. Maybe that's not too voyeuristic, since it's a public place and a public function. Caterpillar, or a whole nest of tent caterpillars, of which you'll find many if you walk along the paths here. Bird song. That's a very good meditative experience, and you can see how many different bird songs you can distinguish. See if it's all coming from the same tree. See if it's one bird, see if it's many birds, see if you've got many species of one bird calling to one another. I know about three of the birds around here. I know the Swainson's thrush, the varied thrush, and the barn swallows. And, well, the robin, of course. But if you listen, you're going to hear a lot more songs than just the ones that those birds make. So listen for bird song. Listen carefully. Record what you hear. So that's an idea for an exercise you can do outside of this, because we're a little pressed for time. Now I wanted to give everyone here a chance to tell one thing from another and describe the differences. And I've been using these conifers as an exercise. I've got two similar, and I'll see if I can get the two things that are most similar of the different things. But cones, I've got a lot of different cones. Now, a lot of people just call them all pine cones. But I don't. what I have here are a Douglas fir cone and a large cone. Well, it's easy to say that one is bigger than the other. But they have many things in common as well as many things that set them apart. So I'm just going to, I'll give these to you and invite you to note their differences. There are pencils and there's paper here to write down your observations or to draw them. Either one works. Now, I've got a more subtle exercise coming up, but let me get... Here, I've got some more. Now, this really is a pine cone. And I've got some more in here. Okay. I've got three different pine cones. These are our three common pines around the village. And back. I invite you to draw or record. All right, and here's a branch from a pine. Part of a branch, anyway. Do you like these? And a fir. Here's two things. Different species of the same genus. And this one maybe a little bit of a challenge. Actually, let me give you a better branch than this one. They're not nearly as alike as you might think. Okay. Next victim. Subtle. Who wants the rocks? Okay. Rocks? Everybody is going to do the first exercise here, but I want to spread it around as much as I can. And I will ask you to share your findings. Okay. Okay. Give you a few minutes, and
the rest of us just sit here and be hurt.
Yeah.
The rest of us just sit here and be hurt.
Oh no! Oh fine.
Sure.
I've offended everyone now. Here's something. I'm going to assault the bouquet. This one is, I will tell you, it's a big challenge. These oxeye daisies are common as dirt, so.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just stop whining. Oxeye daisy, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. Not everybody has to have the same thing. What was I thinking? Here we go. If anyone wants to borrow a hand lens, I have one. You can also use the microscope. Okay, sorry. Thank you for your patience. Well, neither do I.
Okay.
What we're doing is an exercise in close observation. And I've given everybody two contrasting, sometimes subtly contrasting, branches or cones or rocks, and asked them to note their characteristics, compare and contrast. And when you're ready to share your observations with the rest of us, just sing out. Is there anyone who thinks I've given you two things that are exactly the same?
Two of us. No, I mean the two.
Between the two of us, we think that our fan clubs meant one another.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Thank
goodness. I mean, these two are different.
From
yeah. And these two, but you.
But those two are the same,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Not everyone has a unique pair. Well, unlike Louis Agassiz, I'm not going to ask you to do this for 3 days. So if somebody has some observations that you'd like to read out or pass around, if you've made a drawing, I'd be happy to let you do so.
Yeah. Can we work together on it? The two of us could be done the same?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay.
It's impossible to cheat in this class.
I didn't look at her answer.
Was it Woody Allen said that he got expelled for cheating on a philosophy exam because he looked into the soul of his desk mate?
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to read you a description. I don't have enough for everyone, but we've already got you two share. Here's a description of a larch cone.
What is it, larch?
Larch, yeah. Also known as tamarack. Woody, generally red until dry. Well, they're dry. Scales persistent. The scales are the biggest individual parts of that cone. So they're those sort of dry, flaky, woody things. Scales persistent, subtended, and exceeded by thin, long caudate, acute to retuse bracts.
Sure. Just the language we used, didn't
it? Yeah. Now that's a precise scientific description. Subtended means just underneath them, or if you think of that cone as sticking up, those scales are just underneath the cone. So those bracts. Bract is sort of an all-purpose term that botanists use.
How do you spell it?
B-R-A-C-T. Bract. Bracts are what botanists call something when they can't think of any other name for it. So these cones have bracts. Now, what about these bracts? They are thin. Does everyone agree with that? And that means the same to botanists as to everybody else. Acute to retuse. Well, acute means sharp, so pointed. You know, I have to look these things up myself. Retuse is with a small terminal notch in an otherwise rounded or blunt tip. So, you've got something that might go like that. Everyone see that? This would be the retuse tip of the larch cone. And, did anyone notice that? Did these have that?
So this is the larch right here? I was looking at the other one.
Yeah, this is the larch cone. And
yeah, that's kind of rounded.
Yeah, in some cases you can find that the tip actually splits at the top. When these cones were fresher, these characters might have been a little more distinctive. But that's a little detail that most people would miss unless they stared at it for 3 days. And long caudate. Long caudate is with a tail-like terminal appendage. It means it's got a long tail. So these long-tailed thin bracts underneath the cone scales with a terminal tip, terminal notch. And that's how you can tell a larch cone from any other cone you might run across. If it's got that long tail with a pointed or terminal tip. Now it's different from the Douglas fir cone. Two people have Douglas fir cones, and I've got more that I can pass around. And you can note the differences between the two. The descriptions in botanical teas are written with great care and precision precisely because we need to be able to tell things that might superficially look very similar from one another. So here come some pretty good-sized Douglas fir cones and some smaller ones, but they're all... Now, there's a story that goes with the Douglas fir cone, and I don't know if I have enough, but it, yeah, you ought to be able to... someone or crowd around somebody who's got one.
What's the seed part of this?
The seed, actually, if you shake the cone in your hand, you might find a little winged seed come out of it. The seeds are inside the cone scales. And if the Douglas fir cone isn't too old...
Oh, that's not Douglas fir.
Right.
You can see them now.
Yeah, yeah. If you look inside the larch cone, you'll see the little seeds between the cone scales. I am just a little bit short of Douglas fir cones, but if you can get near somebody who's got one. The story is that the Douglas fir cone has the characteristics it does because of a mouse that was seeking refuge from a forest fire. This is a Native American legend, and I have no reason to doubt the truth of it. The mouse ran from tree to tree. It first went to the western red cedar, which has very thin bark and can't survive a forest fire. And the cedar turned it away, said, you know, I'm going to burn up in this fire just like you. So it then ran to the western hemlock. Same problem with the hemlock. Finally got to the Douglas fir, and the Douglas fir said, I have deeply furrowed bark. I'm going to outlast this fire by centuries. So crawl up into my cones, and you can see that its tail and hind legs are still sticking out of the cone scales of that Douglas fir. Okay, I'm going to give you the botanical description of the Douglas fir cone. Now, I want you to know that there are many, many other ways, valid ways of describing a Douglas fir cone. This is one that simply works for the particular purpose that botanists have of telling one thing from another. Cones born near tip of previous year's growth. Well, you couldn't see that unless you were looking at a tree with or a big branch of it. With exserted, that means sticking out. It's the opposite of inserted. Exserted three-lobed bracts subtending and exceeding the scales. Does that make sense to everyone? Well, that's basically it. It's a three-lobed bract that subtends and exceeds the scale. And from that description compared to that of the larch, you've basically got it covered. Now, here's something else about the Douglas fir cone. Yellowish-green to purplish before maturity. Well, I don't have an immature cone to show you. Take my word for it. It's true. Soon deciduous, that is, the cones fall off fairly soon after they mature. Scales pubescent, that means they've got fine hairs on them. You might not be able to see them without a hand lens. Bracts 4 to 7 millimeters broad across tip, middle lobe much the longest. And that's what it says specifically about the Douglas fir cone as opposed to other species within the Douglas fir genus. So there's just a little exercise in close observation, but I really would like to see what other folks might have observed about the things that they've been looking at. And I've got something set up here to show you the difference between two types of true firs. Anyone? This doesn't take any courage, maybe some foolhardiness, but...
Well, I had two firs, I guess, and the clear difference was that there was a different plane of the branches on one versus the other, and some were just perfectly flat, and the other ones were coming off at least on the top half of it. And the same way with the needles were coming off in the same plane of this one. That's the obvious difference, they're sort of around it. But then there was little subtle differences, subtle changes in color and sheen and the odor and the pliability. One of them shed, one of them didn't, but that may be the, how old they are. And one of them had little kind of flowers or buds or something on the other one didn't.
Yeah, the needles of the subalpine fir kind of stick up like that, sort of turning upward, whereas the Pacific silver fir, which can't grow at quite so high an elevation, are more spread out in a single plane, like sprays. Although one interesting thing that distinguishes the Pacific silver fir from the grand fir is that it has needles across the top of the twig that point forward like this, whereas the grand fir, the needles are all to the sides, leaving the top of the twig bare. Hmm. We won't see grand fir around here, but if you had to tell between the two, that would be the giveaway. And there's a subtle difference that you're not liable to see in this light without a hand lens or a microscope. And I would invite you all to come look and see if you can't tell, maybe just through by the naked eye, if the top and bottom of the two leaves of the two different types of fir are the same. The folks who have them see any... any difference between top and bottom of the needles of one and top and bottom of the needles of another?
My needles are square on one and flat on the other. Is that what you meant?
No, actually, it has to do with the coloration.
Oh.
Or the, you know, a little...
There's more difference in color. And one's lighter on the bottom. It's got a little central line running down the middle of the needle. And the other one is... more uniform color.
Yeah, that line is actually little pores, which we know in the business as stomates. The stomates are what allow these things to breathe and also to transpire. That is, the water comes out of the stomates.
Do plants have stomates?
Yes, in fact, just about all plants have stomates. Mosses may not, but just about all of them do because they need to exchange gases in order to photosynthesize. They take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and the energy of the sun and convert carbon dioxide with water to sugar.
I couldn't really see him under that little hand lens, but I think it's a little bit dark in here.
Yeah. This dissecting scope, if I can get it, if I can get these needles to sit still, I can show you top and bottom of subalpine fir and top and bottom of the Pacific silver fir, and you'll see this relatively insignificant but critical difference, and it's the way you can tell them apart, and it's also important for the way they grow and where they live. The subalpine fir grows at higher elevation and is commonly covered by snow for a good part of the year. It's less concerned, because it grows in colder, moister habitats, with losing water than the Pacific silver fir, which grows farther down on the slope and is not as well-watered throughout the year as the subalpine fir. Also, because it's buried by snow, it has more trouble with gas exchange. So it needs to have more pores through which it can take in carbon dioxide and let out oxygen and water. And so, the Pacific silver fir, the one that grows lower down where it might be drier, has stomates, or pores, on only one side of the needle, or leaf, and that would be the underside. The subalpine fir has them on both top and bottom side. And that's how you can tell the two apart. If, for some reason, some of the other vegetative characters are not sharply contrasted. And, of course, we wouldn't know this. We wouldn't know this if somebody hadn't looked long and carefully at the subtle details of the structure and the surface picture of the needles of these two plants.
Do they know, or do you know what, why altitude? Is that a factor for that different?
Well, altitude can be a factor because the concentration of gases is lower at a higher altitude. Sometimes when there's very little cloud cover, you can have greater extremes of hot and cold at altitude. But my speculation is that the reason this and also the mountain hemlock have these pores on both sides of the leaf is because they generally are more in danger of not being able to exchange gases than they are of not having enough water or losing their water too quickly. And that has to do both with the air pressure at that level, concentration of the gases in the atmosphere, and with the snow cover and greater moisture in the subalpine areas where they're liable to be more stressed. Once they get near tree line, they're at the limit of the stresses they can endure, and they will drop out, and you'll end up with maybe only white bark pine at the very highest elevations. So I've got two needles laid out front and back, and if nobody bumps this thing, you can all come take a look and see if you don't see stomates on two sides of the leaves on the left, and only one side of the two leaves on the right. So, you can just go ahead and take a look if you like.
Can you buy that little hand lens anywhere?
Here. This is a 20 power hand lens. And my suggestion for looking at something like this is to hold it up to your nose, steady it against your nose, and then bring the thing you're looking at up to it. Don't hold it away like that. Bring it up close to your eye and keep it steady by holding your hand against your nose.
What's the other one, Tom? That's 20 power.
The other one is a 7 power, but it's got a wider field of view and it's easy to see with it.
I saw, I should tell you, incredible scars and stress on the base of the stem.
I blame myself.
It's correct.
I admit it, I'm scum. I don't deserve to take another breath after what I did to that cow. So, did anybody draw anything? We have some verbal descriptions. Yes?
I made an inference that I hadn't made earlier. I do work with trees quite a bit and have collected cones and extracted seeds from cones. But in the past, I've always discovered that the best seeds for the tree come from the middle of the cone. They're the biggest and the roundest, and they are the most fertile. I mean, they're the ones that seem to sprout. And when I examine the cones more carefully under this exercise, I discovered that the best example of the scales of each of the three species I had occurred right in the middle of the cone in terms of their shape. They were the biggest, the thickest. They had opened out to the greatest degree to allow the seed and the wings to fall. Their spatial symmetry was the most organized, seemed like, in the middle. And what I would infer to be defense mechanisms, the spines or the sap that collected on the tips here, was also most prominent right in the middle of the cone. And that was true or not, I don't know, but it appears that way to me, and that is something that I had never made a connection before.
Yeah, excellent. So, thank you. That's just what I was hoping for. I had an observation when I was hiking toward Copper Basin last week, and I hadn't seen much in the way of, I hadn't seen any, in fact, western hemlock in the area. And finally I did, but it was somewhat higher elevation, or if not, it was on the, by far the wettest places you could find in this vicinity, so in the draws right adjacent to the creeks and streams. And so I was surprised to find it at higher elevation sometimes than even subalpine fir, which would never happen on the west side of the Cascade Crest because it's plenty wet for the western hemlock to grow at ground level or at sea level. Over here, the lower you go, the drier it gets. And so you don't see that species that normally is in the lowlands until you get high enough up a slope to have enough snow melt persistent throughout the year for that species to occur. So that was a revelation to me. So it's the same kind of thing. Once you start paying attention, you see things you never realized. Who else wants to say something?
Well, I'm with my forester husband, and he's psychology, and I was real interested in the intricacies of these cones. However, one thing I did notice is that this one was attached and the other two were unattached, and I wondered if this was an immature cone and these perhaps were more mature and able to survive independent of their branch.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good observation. In fact, the cone that's attached is of the lodgepole pine.
Okay.
And the lodgepole pine cones do stay on the tree for a long time after they mature, and even after they've opened and released their seeds. A lodgepole pine is a variable species, and it covers a wide territory, all the way from the Pacific coast to the Rocky Mountains, and even across the Great Divide. And it has two basic varieties, one of which is the shore pine, which is kind of twisted and gnarled because of the influence of the ocean winds and the salt air tends to sculpture the tree. And the other is the tall, straight, lodgepole version. And they're considered two varieties of the same species botanically. You can cross them, and they'll mate with one another, but they're two distinct varieties. And even within the lodgepole variety, you have some that are in fire-prone areas that have evolved the characteristic of having their cones sealed up with resin until the fire comes through and is hot enough to melt that resin and release the seeds. So they immediately will regenerate, and you get a complete lodgepole pine forest in the wake of a stand-clearing fire. So it is good observation. They do stay on the branch. It is a mature cone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other cones do fall off the trees. You don't find lodgepole pine cones on the ground nearly as much as you do those of the other species. So that's a perfectly valid observation. I could have given you one to catch from the stem, of course, and you wouldn't have been able to see that, but characteristically they are attached to the stem. So aside from the screaming and the marks of torture,
I did have a question that I have. You can see what I have. This one is so tough and hard. I mean, the center is hard. And this one almost wilts under my touch. Mm-hmm. And so I've had to set it down because it does. And it's just a...
Well, it might be you rather than the flower.
It could be. And I noticed that my fingernails were... No. But it's an incredible difference. That this is so sturdy. And underneath the... I don't know what the names of these are, but...
Involucral brass.
Yeah, well, they're involucral brass. And the subtended... the base under these things are so different, too. And this is so fragile. Everything, the base thing that supported it, came apart right away. And yet, they separated right away, but it didn't come apart. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So that was just all interesting to me.
Yeah.
Is this the pistol, the stamen? What's that part?
That's the pistol, yeah.
The pistol. This whole thing just came off and separated.
Yeah. So what you've got left behind there...
You think you destroyed it. I agree.
Actually, this is... These things really contrast sharply, more than you realize. What is left here are the outermost and the innermost whorls of a flower. And a flower may have these whorls reduced or eliminated, but in this case we've got them all. We have the outermost whorl, which consists of sepals. That's the green part of a flower usually, and that's what covers up the bud before it opens. Those are the sepals. In this case, there are five of them, and they are fused. They have five sharp lobes. Sometimes those sepals will all be distinct. They're all distinct in the buttercup. So you've got the outer whorl. There's got to be an eraser here somewhere.
On the whiteboard, there is.
Yeah, well, why don't I use a whiteboard? Okay, sepals, which make up the calyx. That's the outermost whorl of four on a flower. And that would be this thing out here. Petals, which make up the corolla. And that would be... Let's give it three petals that you can see in this cutaway. I'll make the sepals orange. That will make the corolla red. Then you have the stamens. I'm not going to give you the name for the stamens because it's too weird, but there's a collective term for the stamens. And the stamens are anthers and filaments. The filaments are the stalks, and the anthers are the pollen pods. Any questions? And finally, you have the pistil. And the pistil consists of three basic parts. The stigma, which is the sticky thing at the top that receives the pollen. The style, which is this stalk. And the ovary, which contains the ovules, which become the seeds. So, what we've got here is the outermost sepals and the innermost pistil. And if I... rip this thing open, you can see the ovary underneath, and it contains within it the ovules. And I could slice that open with the razor blade, and you could see it under the microscope if we had time, which we don't. And then the petals here are collectively called the corolla, have attached to them the stamens. I'll pass that around so you can see it.
And there are the final hairs?
Well, the hairs are different. That's just
actually, it's sort of a runway for the pollinators. They come in here, and they stop here and get the nectar, and they get the pollen on, and they go to the next flower, and the flower has a blessed vent. So, this is something you maybe never knew about a flower. Since time is short, I'm going to tell you a mind-blowing thing about the poor murdered daisy.
Don't feel bad. It was murdered before you did it. Somebody did it earlier.
That's true. And I don't feel bad.
Good.
Maybe you should feel bad. But I don't. Okay. What we have here is not one flower, but dozens of flowers. This is an inflorescence which is composed of many, many individual flowers. Ray flowers on the outside. And these ray flowers contain one petal only. And inside, they may or may not have the anthers and the pistils. Inside, you have flowers that are tubular, that have five lobes, and contain within them both stamens and pistils. The yellow disc is actually a collection of flowers that look like this. Tubular flowers, and within them there's a stigma, or there's a pistil, and there are stamens. You know, a dandelion has a big seed head. Each one of those seeds represents a separate flower from the dandelion head. So this is a compound inflorescence. What's happened is that flowers used to have short stalks, and you've seen them like on Queen Anne's lace. And those stalks have gotten shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, and they become condensed. So this is a condensation of a whole bouquet of flowers.
So each one of those little compartments in yellow is a flower in
itself.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then why do we have the big petals around?
To trick the pollinators.
Are you almost done? Should I go?
Yeah, no.
I don't mind going next door.
I'm clearing out. They've had enough of me.
If you're in the middle of it, I'll go next door.
No. Yes. We got to go. They've had all they can stand.
Kill three flowers.
Am I right? Thank you all for your attentiveness.
Thank you.